Welcome back.
Good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back.
I'm glad I'm not restricted with chains in my house.
All right, we have a bell. Are we live on the internet? Cool, welcome. There's handouts back there. Daniel, you got them? Yeah, should be the top one. For those of you that were looking, perhaps, yesterday, I apologize for not getting the handouts on the website until this morning, but this is the handout for tonight's class and Sunday. So if I'm late today, I'm actually, 4 days ahead for Sunday. So that evens out, and we'll call it good. But yeah, we're going to try to do Judges 19, 20, and 21, which is quite a bit of material over two classes. And so all of the questions for the three chapters, and as you know, these questions are nothing comprehensive or intensive, maybe I should say, but simply some things to be thinking about, things to be looking for, overview, big picture, thematic type things to be looking at while we're in class and also on your own time reading before or after class. But these questions will be for all three chapters, and we'll get probably, hopefully, through the first two of those chapters, 19 and 20 tonight, and then talk about chapter 21 on Sunday. So, Judges 19, but before we do that, let's recap Judges 17 and 18. Remember that Judges 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21, the last five chapters, are an appendix of sorts. We are no longer talking about judges, meaning these are not stories of deliverers that God raised up to defeat the enemies of Israel. These are two stories that are a little bit maybe confusing to understand why they are being told at all, and particularly why they are being told tacked on here at the end of the stories of the judges when they don't have anything to do with those deliverers, but they are happening at the same time or around the same time as the other stories. These are the more unfamiliar stories in Judges. You probably coming into this class were very familiar with the likes of Ehud and Shamgar and Samson and Jephthah and Gideon. But you maybe were not as fresh on the story of Micah and the Danites or the crime at Gibeah. And so these being less familiar, we want to maybe work harder to remember them and to appreciate their place in the overall narrative. So let's review what we studied on Sunday, Judges 17 and 18. And we'll start with a basic sequence of events and then talk some about the significance. Okay, Micah and the Danites. Let's talk about how that story goes. Who wants to start? You can shout out. We'll just do this quickly. The basic plot summary of Judges 17 and 18. We start with a guy named Micah. And how does the story begin with Micah? He is returning stolen money. To who? His mother, okay? And how does his mother feel about that? Yes, great. Hallelujah, literally, right? She praises Jehovah, and her praise for Jehovah is so genuine, so earnest, that what does she vow is going to be done with the money that's been returned? What'd you say? Yeah, sorry, part of the money that's returned, at least, is going to be used for what? Yeah, building an idol. And that alone gives us a sense of where we're at the time period of the judges, that a vow to Jehovah of stolen money is made into an idol, okay? And not only does Micah make this precious metal into an idol, he makes his son a priest. Until what happens? A Levite wanders by, and what happens next? Yeah, he's a priest, okay? So he hires him, he fills his hand. Remember, that's the literal word for consecrating. Later on, the Levite will say, he hired me, so hey, got a yearly salary, got clothes, food, you can be my priest, and this is just perfect. Now we have our images, and now we have a bona fide, right, priest, from the tribe of Levi. Right? This nothing could be better. Now I know, he says at the end of chapter 17, Jehovah will prosper me. All right, then the Danites enter into the story. And why do the Danites enter into the story? What are they doing? They are spying out the land. But I thought they've been living in the land. Why are they spying out the land? Because they hadn't conquered their territory. They had been pushed out. Now they're looking for new land. And so they send spies up to the north of Israel to find territory for them to possess. And the spies come through come by the house of Micah, where this Levite is serving as priest. And the spies stop by to do what? The first time around. They stop by to do what? Yeah, to check with the priest, to inquire of the Lord whether or not they should go on this. I guess I left that out. So it was even more concise on the PowerPoint than I wanted to be. So the Danites originally stop in chapter 18, verse 7 and following to check and see, should we go up? Sorry, it's around verse 6. And the Levite, whether or not he actually knew God's will, it's questionable, but he says, go, the Lord is with you. So the Danites head north, and they find that the land is great up there, and the best thing about this new territory up in the north is what? What really attracts the Danites to this section of territory in the north? It's far away from any allies, meaning it's easy to conquer. Should be no big deal. The stuff, down in the south was too hard. They couldn't do it, but this will be easier. And so they make that their goal. And then the second time they all pass through and pass by the house of Micah, they stop to forcefully steal Micah's idols and his priest. And when Micah tries to stop them, what do the Danites say? When he says, hey, that's my idols, that's my priest, you can't do that. The Danites say,
we're bigger than you.
Yeah, we're bigger than who's gonna, you and what army, right? Who's gonna stop us? And so they go up and they conquer. The last thing we learn in chapter 18 is that they conquered Laish, which becomes the city of Dan. And really, from this point on in Israelite history, when you think of Dan or hear of Dan, it's that city and the territory there in the far north, which is the new territory that that tribe had conquered. Okay, here's a map of what's going on here. It's going to be a little bit hard to see. I have better maps for the chapters we're studying tonight. Here's the hill country of Ephraim right in the middle. This down here by the sea, remember the Philistines had this territory, and they were never driven out, really. And Dan, original allotment was right here bordering the Philistines. Remember, Samson was the tribe of Dan. And that's where all this action took place, was between him and the Philistines, because that was the original allotment for Dan. But they are wanting to head up here to Laish. And so passing through the hill country of Ephraim is where the action happens at Micah's house. And then this is where they ultimately end up. Let's talk about the significance of it. What is the important verse? Remember, this is actually your memory work, part of your memory work for the class. It's the last verse of the book, but it also gets used once in chapter 17, verbatim. And what is that all-important statement made by the author of Judges? There was no king in Israel, is the first part of it. And everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And really, that is a... You could say, and I think John pointed this out in one of the Samson lessons, that really can, I think, should be the lens by which you see the whole book of Judges, but especially these last two stories in this story. He says it right in the middle of the text. He stops in the middle of the story to tell you that everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes. And so you see that in this story. You see that really everybody at some point is motivated by greed, okay? Micah steals the money. That seems like a greedy move at the beginning of the story. His mom, Muffy, mentioned this. The mother doesn't give all the money to the devotion for this graven image for Yahweh, which would suggest that she wanted to keep most of it for herself. The Levite shows his greed by, he'll do, if you're going to pay me, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll serve as as priest for you. Micah, I'll serve for priest for you. The Danites, pay me enough. That'll be great. And the Danites, of course, in their stealing of the ephod and the molten images from the house of Micah shows their greed as well. So everyone does what is right in their own eyes. And as is true today and really has been true as long as money has been a thing, I guess, that's what motivates everybody. People want money. They want more things. And so this story, really, everybody falls into that. But it's more than just the money and greed. It's what's convenient. It's what's best for me. You see the Danites, again, their motivation for seeking out the territory around Laish is that, well, it's easy for us. It's convenient. It suits our purposes, okay? When you would ask about Yahweh, Jehovah, and how people think, their attitude towards him in this story, we would see that whatever inquiry of Yahweh there is, it is superficial. It's, feeling like you need to check that box of asking what God would think, and the Levite doesn't really put much, concern into what Jehovah would really say. He just says, yep, go for it, because God has blessed you. And then, as we've talked about, and this will be relevant in our story tonight, might makes right. It's another principle that we see and fits nicely with. There's no king in Israel. There's no authority. You could almost leave out, whether it was a good king or a bad king, right? At least with a bad king, you still have some level of authority and governance and a limit, for evildoers or whatever. But with no authority, and of course, as God is not recognized as the authority in Israel, whoever's strongest prevails in the end. And that's the situation in this first of the two stories in our epilogue of the book of Judges. Anything else that you want to say about this story as we wrap it up and move on to chapter 19? Okay, remember, this is one of your items, your objectives, is to be able to summarize this story as well as the one we're doing tonight. So lock it away in your memory and be able to pull it out for the test that you'll have before the end of the class. Not tonight's class, but before the end of the class next week. Judges 19 to 21. We're in the same area here. So hill country of Ephraim, and that's where the action is going to start, but also in the south here, Bethlehem moving north. We'll come back to this. But let's read Judges 19. And viewer discretion is advised, especially in this chapter. This is perhaps the most horrifying story in all of Scripture. I don't know if that may be too bold of a claim, but there's parts of this that we don't even know what to say about it because of how awful it is. So with that warning, let's read chapter 19 and just one, try to get a sense of what are the events, what's happening in the story, try to keep it all in view over the course of the 30 verses that we'll be reading. There's irony, there's things that are odd, that are strange, that are confusing. Obviously, there are things that are tragic. Try to understand what those things are and what that might signify to us or what it might tell us about the story or what we're supposed to take from it. And then think about what stories are reminiscent as we read chapter 19, the 30 verses here. What stories are you reminded of? And hopefully you'll think of at least one, if not more than one, two or three or four other stories from the Old Testament that come to mind, and what that might tell us about what's going on. Judges 19, we'll read the whole thing here. Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite, different Levite, by the way, staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now on the fourth day they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he might spend the night there again. On the fifth day he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. When the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey so that you may go home." But the man was not willing to spend the night. So he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is, Jerusalem. And there was with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was already gone. And the servant said to his master, "Please come, let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." However, his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah." He said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, but he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjaminites. He lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. An old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" He said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Judah, but I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything." The old man said, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." So he took him into his house and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him." Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man." But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning, and then let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. When the master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let us go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it and take counsel and speak up." Okay. What do we want to say about this story? I'm interested in some ways in just hearing your reactions to this, maybe using some of these questions as a guide. Are there things that stand out to you maybe most strongly from this story? Something that is, again, ironic or confusing, especially tragic or poignant from this story, or connections that you want to make from this story? What do we want to say about this? Brian?
If I got my prophets correct, unfaithful wife.
Elijah went after his unfaithful wife, which was a symbol of God's love for Israel.
I don't know if that's working. But
Hosea, if you can hear Brian, he makes connection to Hosea and going after unfaithful wife of harlotry and seeking her back. What else stands out from the story? Brian's got another one.
Well, I find it interesting that he loved his concubine and pursued her, although she was unfaithful. But yet, when the men of Benjamin saw her, he gave her over to them for whether she was killed or not, a horrible
I don't think we're on again, but anyway, it's a contradiction of love and to turn her over to these men. Who could do that to his wife?
So that's one of the questions that we would have from the story is how, what do we make of the Levite? And particularly, as Brian talks about, his feelings for, his duty towards this concubine. Positive aspects, negative aspects of this. Do we see nobility in anything that he does? Yeah, Jackie.
I don't think any of his actions were for nobility. I think they were protecting his own pride. I mean, in this time for him to be a man with a concubine, he probably had multiple concubines, for one of them to escape, get away, however she left him, that would have been embarrassing. That was his property that left him. That's why he went to go get her. Personally, I don't think he went to go get her because he loved her and he thought she was the greatest thing. It was his property. So he treated her as such and sacrificed his property so that he wouldn't be abused and taken advantage of. There was nothing noble. Personally, I mean, you know.
Is there other evidence in the story that he sees her, as Jackie says, as property? Or if you want to take a contrarian view and disagree with Jackie, you know, I'd love that. But do we see evidence of treating her as, you know, a person that he loves? Or evidence that he's just viewing her as a thing that he possesses? Mike?
Well, when he got to the doorstep, he just told her to get up. He wasn't very sympathetic towards her at all.
And sometimes the most striking things in stories are the simplest or most, unassuming, okay? I mean, verse 26 says that she was ravished, these awful things were done to her, unimaginable, and she falls down at the door, and then verse 27 says, when her master got up in the morning. So what had he done when he had thrown her out? As Brian mentioned this, he throws her out to these evil men. What does he do? He retires for the night. Okay, and I would suggest that even that final act, maybe this is not like that controversial, the cutting her up into 12 pieces and sending her out, to me that's not a way to honor someone who has died that you love. That's more, I don't know what it is, but it's a statement of, as maybe to use Jackie's word, my property has been damaged, lost, violated, whatever. By the way, there's a connection there. Does anybody know what it is? Another story that particular detail will remind us of, not to give too much away. So that could be one, but no. This is actually this happens in the United Kingdom. There's actually multiple connections to this, but the cutting up of something and sending it out as a message to all of Israel. Someone else did that. I wish you could pick with this clicker, you know, which points come up, because you know I would like to go farther ahead here. But let me just well. we'll come back to that. How about that? We'll save it. What is the main story that comes to our mind when we read Judges 19? This is Sodom and Gomorrah and the story of Lot. In fact, I was listening to a sermon from Judges 19 today, and Beth walked in and she said, "Oh, is this Lot, the Lot story?" She had been reading that in her Bible reading today, and you could very easily get them confused. But you remember the Lot story, right? I mean, we could go through and make our list of connections, okay? But the two angelic visitors come to Sodom, and they are not received. And so Lot, who is also himself an outsider, right, not of the city of Sodom, but living there, he takes these two visitors in, not only for hospitality's sake, but for fear of what might happen to them. And the evil men of Sodom come demanding these visitors for the same reasons that they are demanded in Judges 19. In that case, though, what happens at the end of the story? How does that story resolve? You have a very similar track of these two stories up to the point where, you know, they're pounding on the door, send them out to us. But how does the Genesis story end with Lot? Yeah, the angels blind them, and then that's when they grab Lot, let's get out of here, and the evil men don't actually get their prey, so to speak, okay? But how does this story end? Well, it ends tragically. Yeah, and she is not spared. There is no angel that steps in this time to keep these evil men from doing... What would be the lesson? And the fact that this story is so similar to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, what does the author perhaps want the reader to conclude from that or to take from that similarity?
Israel is now just as bad as it was in Sodom.
Israel, Steve says, is just as bad as Sodom and Gomorrah. In fact, you could even say they've become worse, right? Or at least the story ends in a worse way even than Sodom and Gomorrah, but that is clearly in view here. So a few things. So the idea of hospitality is one of the keys. This does not make sense to us really at all. This is true throughout all the Bible, Old and New Testament. The ancient people valued hospitality higher than what we could ever, you know, really comprehend. And hospitality is different. For us, hospitality is like having your friends over for lunch on Sunday. Hospitality in the ancient world was travelers, strangers. There was no hotels. There's no inns. You had to depend on people taking you into your home. And all throughout the Bible, as other ancient literature, the virtue of hospitality is one of the highest virtues that exists for a person, okay? And you can trace that, see that in all kinds of stories, both Old and New Testament. But that kind of, carries a lot of this story here. Remember that the father-in-law is insistent on demanding that the Levites stay day after day after day. And we might remember stories like in Genesis 24, when Abraham's servant goes to the house of, Bethuel, Laban's father, to get a wife, this time for Isaac. And the Bethuel, I'm remembering his name right, says, stay on. He's wanting to show him hospitality. Isaac's servant says, nuh-uh, I'm out of here. I've come for this mission. I've accomplished it, and I'm back to my master Abraham. Okay. In Genesis 30, Isaac's son Jacob is in the same place. He's in the house of Laban, and there's it's not the exact same, but Laban does the same kind of thing, imposing hospitality on him, and it really ends up being harmful to Jacob, who stays really longer than he should have, and pays the price for it. Same sort of thing happens here to the Levite, where his father-in-law is imposing hospitality, and that gets him in trouble for what reason? You see the chain of events here, okay? He stays a night, he stays another night, and then he stays into the afternoon. Have you ever done this? This happens to us, when we stop in New Orleans on the way home and see my aunt and uncle. It's like, okay, yeah, we're going to leave at 7 a.m., to make sure we can get into Atlanta before dark. Well, you get there and you're visiting and you visit. Oh, look at the time. Now the trip is more difficult because we're leaving later in the day. They would never have had to stop somewhere for the night if they would have left when they're supposed to. Okay, that's a sidetrack kind of thing. There's also something going on with the city of Jebus, or Jebus, which is the city of Jerusalem. Remember, this city is not conquered until when?
David
conquers and names it Jerusalem. At this point, it's still run by the Jebusites. This was their capital city. And what does the Levites say when the servant suggests, hey, let's just stay here? I mean, you know, it's a nice city. What does he say? And it's not said explicitly, but if you're reading into that, why do you think he wants to stay where there's Israelites and not stay in a city of foreigners? Yeah, that'd be, isn't that ironic, okay? Passing up this pagan city because, oh, they're, you know, they won't receive us kindly, and then what they receive in Gibeah of Benjamin is worse than it could possibly imagine. So by implication, you know, it's almost like the author's saying, this would not have happened if they had stopped in the city of the Jebusites. We don't know that for sure, obviously, but you can infer that, or at least that's part of what's being hinted at. So in that way, and in the connection to Sodom, the Israelites here at Gibeah look worse than pagans past and present. I think, as Jackie mentioned, that you see a attitude of selfishness in the Levite really from beginning to end. By the way, there is some ambiguity about why she went back to Bethlehem. Okay, depending on how you translate that idea, it could be that she was unfaithful to him, and then, you know, after her unfaithfulness, left and was living with her father. It could be that that phrase simply means she just left him for some reason, okay, and left him to go home, stay at dad's house, it's more pleasant. Or it actually could be interpreted or translated that she was angry with him for something he had done, and then went home to be with her father. So that separation is not very clear there. That doesn't really necessarily change a whole lot, because the Levite really all the way through shows himself to be concerned for him and himself and his things rather than having any sort of real concern. And now here is what I want to get to. The other person who cuts up a living thing and puts it on a cart to be paraded over Israel as a call to action. Granny, did you have one? What did you say? Oh, 12 parts. Well, I assume for the 12 tribes, right? Saul does this. By the way, what tribe is Saul from? Tribe of Benjamin. What city is he from? City of Gibeah. Okay. But when the men of Jabesh-Gilead, which will also come up in this story on Sunday, when the men of Jabesh-Gilead are being threatened by the Ammonites in 1 Samuel 11, Saul has just become king. He cuts up an ox into 12 pieces, sends it over Israel, all over Israel, and says, so shall it happen to you if you do not show up to help fight the Ammonites in Jabesh-Gilead. And it works on that instance. That's a pretty good story. Maybe the best story that involves Saul in all of 1 Samuel. But this is eerily reminiscent of it and doesn't make the Gibeahites, the Benjamites of Gibeah, look good at all. Okay, so we're back to our map here. This is where the Levite is from. He's from the hill country of Ephraim. Bethlehem is where the concubine is from, so he goes down there to get her, and then they're traveling northward back up to the hill country, and they bypass what will be known as Jerusalem and stay in Gibeah. Okay? That's where the evil deed happens, and right away he starts trying to summon people from the rest of the tribes to action. And we started reading about that at the end of chapter 19. So now let's read chapter 20, which is pretty long. So bear with me. We're going to read the whole thing, and whatever we get a chance to talk about, we'll talk about. We do have time to talk more about it on Sunday. But the everybody else that responds to this call, think about how they respond. Do we like their response? Is their response good? Is it righteous? Benjamin will then respond to the response. What do we make of Benjamin's reaction in all this? And Jehovah's name is going to be called more, and he actually will speak in this chapter, maybe more than we would have expected that to happen in a story like this. So what is Jehovah's role in this story, and then what are the big takeaways? Again, why is this here? What are we supposed to make of it? Okay, picking up where the 12 pieces of this poor young lady are sent out to the tribes as a call to action. Chapter 20 of Judges. Then all the sons of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, came out. The congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. The chiefs of all the people, even of all the tribes of Israel, took their stand in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now, the sons of Benjamin heard that the sons of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. And the sons of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wickedness take place?" So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "I came with my concubine to spend the night at Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. And I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance, for they committed a lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Behold, all you sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here." Verse 8. Then all the people arose as one man, saying, "Not one of us will go to his tent, nor will any of us return to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot, and we will take 10 men out of 100 throughout the tribes of Israel, and 100 out of 1,000, and 1,000 out of 10,000 to supply food for the people, that when they come to Gibeah of Benjamin, they may punish them for all the disgraceful acts that they have committed in Israel." Thus all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united as one man. Then the tribes of Israel sent men throughout the entire tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What is this wickedness that has taken place among you? Now then, deliver up the men, the worthless fellows of Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel." But the sons of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the sons of Israel. The sons of Benjamin gathered from the cities to Gibeah to go out to battle against the sons of Israel. From the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, beside the inhabitants of Gibeah who were numbered 700 choice men. Out of all these people, 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Then the men of Israel, besides Benjamin, were numbered 400,000 men who draw the sword. All these were men of war. Verse 18. Now, the sons of Israel arose, went up to Bethel, and inquired of God, and said, "Who shall go up first for us to the battle against the sons of Benjamin?" Then Jehovah said, "Judah shall go up first." So the sons of Israel arose in the morning and camped against Gibeah. The men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel arrayed for battle against them at Gibeah. Then the sons of Benjamin came out at Gibeah and felled to the ground on that day 22,000 men of Israel. But the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and arrayed for battle again in the place where they had arrayed themselves the first day. The sons of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening and inquired of Jehovah, saying, "Shall we again draw near for battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin?" And Jehovah said, "Go up against them." Then the sons of Israel came up against the sons of Benjamin the second day. Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah the second day and fell to the ground again, 18,000 men of the sons of Israel. All these drew the sword. Then all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept. Thus they remained there before Jehovah and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Jehovah. Sons of Israel inquired of Jehovah, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before it to minister in those days, saying, "Shall I yet go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?" And Jehovah said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." So Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah. The sons of Israel went up against the sons of Benjamin on the third day and arrayed themselves against Gibeah as at other times. The sons of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city, and they began to strike and kill some of the people as at other times on the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the field about 30 men of Israel. The sons of Benjamin said, "They are struck down before us, as at the first." But the sons of Israel said, "Let us flee, that we may draw them away from the city to the highways." Then the men of Israel arose from their place and arrayed themselves at Baal Tamir. And the men of Israel in ambush broke out of their place, even out of Meragaba. When 10,000 choice men from all Israel came against Gibeah, the battle became fierce. But Benjamin did not know the disaster was close to them. And Jehovah struck Benjamin before Israel, so that the sons of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day, all who drew the sword. Verse 36, so the sons of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. When the men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah, the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush also deployed and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed sign between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they would make a great cloud of smoke rise from the city. And the men of Israel turned in the battle, and Benjamin began to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel. For they said, "Surely they are defeated before us, as in the first battle." But when the cloud began to rise from the city in a column of smoke, Benjamin looked behind them, and behold, the whole city was going up in smoke to heaven. Then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were terrified, for they saw that disaster was close to them. Therefore, they turned their backs before the men of Israel toward the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them, while those who came out of the cities destroyed them in the midst of them. They surrounded Benjamin, pursued them without rest, and trod them down opposite Gibeah toward the east. Thus 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were valiant warriors. The rest turned and fled toward the wilderness, to the rock of Rimmon. But they caught 5,000 of them on the highways and overtook them at Gittim and killed 2,000 of them. So all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000 men who draw the sword. All these were valiant warriors. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, and they remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. The men of Israel then turned back against the sons of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, both the entire city with all the cattle and all that they found. They also set on fire all the cities which they found. Whew, okay. We can talk about their response if we have time. I think we should have about 4 minutes. But I'm most curious about the second question. What is Jehovah's role in all of this? Again, he's a fairly active character in this story, being named, being spoken to, and speaking himself. What is God doing from what we can tell? What is his role?
It was God that chose Judah to go up against the sons of Benjamin, and it was God who, for whatever reasons that I don't understand, did allow the Israelites to fall in the first two battles, but by Jehovah's own words, he gave over the Benjamites in the third battle to give them victory.
Okay, theories on this mystery that Brian puts forth for us. Why is it that God says Judah will go up first, they go out, and they lose? Bunch of Israelites die, Benjamin has the upper hand. Come back for the second battle, and Jehovah says, go up. And they go up, and same thing happens. A bunch of Israelites get killed, Benjamin has the upper hand. And the third time around, they ask, and Jehovah says, go up. This time, I'll give you the battle, and the Benjamites are defeated. Why? I don't know if this happens anywhere else where God says go up and it's unsuccessful. John?
It seems as though they have the numbers in their favor. Like if God was not involved in a battle, that the people of Israel would be the clear expected winner just by count, unless I misunderstood that. And so God is showing this isn't because of your mass, it's because I will or will not allow it. And I will maybe even show my justice through that mechanism.
Albert? And while Daniel's traveling, so just to clarify, part of what you're saying is maybe like a Gideon situation, like the numbers being on one side would put the emphasis on their strength, But the way it all works out ends up putting the emphasis on God's will. Is that kind of one of the things you're saying? Okay. Albert? Yeah, he doesn't have the microphone, so he can't refute my summary. But Albert?
God's answering the question. If you see it, or as I'm seeing it on the context, they ask, who should go? Their question is answered in the context specifically as it's asked. Now, we don't know all the full details of it, but twice they ask who should, and then on the third one, they're coming back with, should we be defeated? So I'm just seeing where God is doing as he will. At this time, God chose to spoke directly to them, different for us today, but I see God answering their question. And was their question really worded correctly? Is the question what's in my mind?
Dale Steve has a comment up here, again, while you're doing that. It is interesting, to Albert's point, that the first question implies they're going to go anyway and simply ask who should go up first. Now, the counter to that is that the second question is, shall we go up? And they're told yes. But I still think there may be something to what Albert's saying. Steve?
Well, God is correcting a disobedient nation. He's correcting them as a father would his own children. And I think that's typical throughout generations and throughout the times that men have been upon this earth. So that's my thought about that. It says Jehovah's role in all of this is his role, as it's always been, as a father, correcting his children.
The idea of discipline. Okay, I thought Brian was going to make some comment. The role of discipline, Steve brings up, that maybe it wasn't just the Benjamites who needed a whipping, so to speak, right? And so Steve points to the fact that the entire nation is clearly disobedient, and it could be, again, we're not told this explicitly, but I think it's a fairly solid conclusion to see all of this, and you almost, by the end, forget what the sides were even about. And which side is right, which side is wrong, although maybe that's where we can start on Sunday, is talking about which side is in the right and which side is in the wrong, either or both. But I think the point by the end of the story is, how could this happen, that you have a full-on military conflict, a war between brothers, between the tribes of Israel and their youngest brother, Benjamin, and tens of thousands of Israelites dying, and essentially a whole tribe being erased almost from the role in Israel, which is how the rest of the story, where that goes. So we'll talk. Have your thoughts about the Civil War and the rights and rationales on both sides. We'll talk about that a little bit and then finish up in chapter 21 on Sunday. Thank you so much. Don't lose your handout. I don't want to have to hand you another one on Sunday. Waste of paper.